Welcome to the Opium Den. I'm Daniel Williams. Well, it's Thursday night, time for another chat inside the Opium Den. I hope everybody is feeling good this evening, had a good day. It's Thursday, week's almost over, and feeling pretty good down here. We've had a lot of rain lately, which makes our grass literally grow before our eyes. One of the nice things about living in the tropics, at least the tropical zone of Florida. So tonight we have as our guest Brian C. Bennett. Brian is a drug policy advocate. He's an aggregator of facts that you should know, and he runs a website, The Anti-Drug War. All you need to do is Google that, and you will be brought to Brian's address, and you can get a tremendous amount of very good information aggregated in one place. So we're going to talk to Brian tonight. Got a couple of subjects to discuss. And as always, if you'd like to comment or if you have a question, right there on the home page of the Opium Den, it says email Daniel. So if you want to send me an email with regards to our conversation or just something that you want to comment or question, please feel free to give us a call, send us an email. I'm getting ready to call Brian, so I got my mind a little crossed there. So we're giving Brian a call, and he should answer. I spoke with him a minute ago to get our sound checks together. So here he comes, hopefully. If not, well, then I got a lot to do on my own tonight with this deal. Answer the phone, Brian. It was 2 minutes ago when we spoke. Hello.
Hello.
Brian Bennett.
Hey, Daniel.
How you
Sorry,
doing?
My phone was acting freaky.
Oh, that's okay. That it's freaky on this end as well. So welcome to your starring turn here at the Opium Den. We're going
Thank you very much, sir.
Well, not a problem. We're going to talk about a couple of things. And at the top of the show, I introduced you and I told everyone to Google anti-drug war, and they'll get right to your site. And there's a tremendous amount of information there. Some of it we'll talk about here. But this is what I want to talk. You and I haven't talked about this before, but this is what I kind of like to focus our conversation this evening. You know, I think the biggest problem that people have, even those who are behind the idea of repealing drug prohibition, is that they really just don't know what it's going to look like. So I thought tonight that you and I could discuss what the regulatory scheme would look like if we got our shit together and repealed drug prohibition, kind of like paint the picture of you know, what it would actually look like, what this regulated and controlled market would look like for the sale of narcotics and all of the other drugs. Because, again, that's one thing that doesn't get talked about that much. You know, the only thing that does get said is that the prohibitions say we're just going to turn into an addict nation. But obviously, we don't believe that will happen. So let's move in that direction. And right off the top, give me if you were designing the regulatory scheme, how would you do it? What do you think it should look like out there as far as acquisition, cost structure, where you get it, where you can't get it, things like that? If you were the guy making that decision, how would you set it up, Brian?
Well, that's a good one, and I do think it would be not that difficult to come up with a scheme that would work and be palatable enough to the vast majority of people if they understood all the ramifications about every aspect of the drug war, and then realize the big problem is that it's such a huge issue with so many different facets that people have a hard time really grasping much of it. But in a legal regulated market, I would do three things off the top of my head that I can think of that would make a lot of sense. I would establish once and for all in the Constitution the magic age, because we're suffering from some kind of mental disorder.
The magic age? What do you mean the magic age?
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're 18, you're allowed to do something.
Oh, the magic age. I thought you said the magic age.
Yeah.
Oh, you're saying
the magic age.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a good place to start.
East Coast fan talker. I'll try to enunciate.
So how old do I have to be to go to go wherever it's going to be sold and buy a gram of Coke?
I say 18. I mean, it doesn't really matter. The issue is to make it less arbitrary than it is now. It's absurd that we have different notions of, well, you're not quite developed enough to smoke tobacco, but by gosh, we'll sell you a gun. Or you can join the army and go.
Well, you can smoke tobacco at 18. You're old enough at 18. Would you lower Would you lower the age?
I'd buy it now. Even that. Anyway.
Remember the rules, Brian.
Really.
When I interrupt.
No problem.
So we can buy. You have to be 21 to buy alcohol, so would you reduce the legal age?
I don't care what the age is. I just want somebody to, you know, let's carve it in stone. Put it in the Constitution. Here's the magic age. You're allowed to do everything at this age.
What is the magic age in your mind? 18 is what you... So that'd be for everything. We'd lower the age for alcohol and...
Absolutely.
18 would be the magic age.
Absolutely. Then the second important factor would be to do realistic education, not just in terms of, you know, proper formal education in classes or whatever you would want to do with your children growing up in your personal world, but true education in the sense of you want me to be a responsible drug user. The alcohol ads crack me up because they say, please drink responsibly, but then they don't let you know how. What you need to know how to drink responsibly is how much alcohol you're actually drinking. And in most states in our nation, you can look at a beer label all day long with a microscope and never find out how much alcohol is in the beer you're drinking. So clearly we need to have realistic labeling. Here's how this product is intended to be used. Here's the dosage amount that you should take. Here's the frequency at which you may take that dose. Here's the dose at which point you're clearly leading into trouble. It's not really different from what's done with pharmaceutical labeling. So
we know there's going to be a skull and crossbones on every fucking package. So
absolutely.
But they should put
them in your birth certificate.
So
you're 18
years old, and I can walk in where? And in your scheme, where would I? Where do you think we should be able to?
I would imagine that the states would be pissing and moaning to create their own rules for how to do that. You know, to avoid offending community sensibilities and whatever other nonsense they would decide made sense to them. Okay, go. But I would say we have the model of drive-through beer, you know, warehouses in several states.
Yeah, but is that a good idea? Do you think that's a good idea to have drive-through?
Yeah, I think that availability should not be there should be very limited attempts to limit overall availability. It should be restricted certainly to those who are deemed to be adult, whatever magic age is.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking about drive-throughs as a concept.
I wouldn't have a drive-through. Well, maybe you could have like drive-through.
No, what I'm saying is, what exists now, drive-throughs to buy alcohol. I mean, do you think that's a good idea on its face that we should be able to just?
Oh no, I think it's a horrible idea.
Okay, so you're not saying you're not modeling your.
No. I just said that the states, you know, basically are going to create their own rules, and to a large extent, okay, let them do that. But what we have to bear in mind is that let's apply some sense in the rules. Yeah, it's dumb to have, you know, drive-through beer places. But a different model would be something like they do in California and several other states where you can actually buy any kind of alcoholic beverage in a grocery store, up to and including, you know, distilled spirits.
Well, no, but do you think the grocery stores are where these drugs should be sold?
doing that. Yeah, I agree. I mean, the drug laws are absurd, and no matter what you do, you know, you're always going to come up with some situation which is absurd.
Well,
selling the currently illegal drugs, if we narrowed our focus that way, I would say you could sell pot anywhere that you sell alcohol. If it's accessible in those venues, then by gosh, you should be able to buy pot there too, because it's far more benign. The chemical drugs, I think you should buy at a drugstore, surprisingly enough. Where a pharmacist could give you advice, you could ask questions of educated people, you would be at a it short of getting the absolute lowest cost.
How many questions would you have for a pharmacist about cocaine? Do I snort it up both nostrils, or do I favor
any other than how much? But yeah, seriously,
I am being serious. I mean,
well, okay, I'm sorry.
just
look at the models of how we live our life now and how markets tend to take care of themselves, and the most successful markets are those that are, obviously create some level of sensible limits, and that leads to the third thing, which is taxation. You can't have excessive taxation. If you do, then you invite the black market, and,
when people go to buy alcohol, They don't get a 60-second spiel from the clerk on...
Oh, no. You have to hear it. If you wanted to ask a question, at least you've got somebody that knows what the hell they're talking about. You know, instead of buying it at 7-Eleven or off some guy in the street. You know, if you're buying your drugs at a pharmacy, then just like with any other pill, if you have questions, ask. You know, if you've got some kind of medical condition, you're worried that using whatever that thing is going to impact that, well, there's the guy you need to talk to. So in that sense, not that you have to sit there and listen to a stupid lecture about, oh, this is bad for you. Well, okay, so what? Shut up and sell it to me.
So you're thinking that, pharmacies like, CVS, Walgreens, that would be your distribution source for narcotics at least?
Absolutely, and that's where I would expect to go buy LSD or a Grateful Dead concert.
Well, I think one would preface the other in a regulated marketplace, but we've established that you're thinking that drugstores, CVS, those type of places would be the distribution center. So, how much do you think if we do this, what price would you put on a gram of coke?
Well, I don't know what the exact economic factors would be in determining the right price point, but certainly it would be well below today's $100 a gram or whatever the latest average is. I mean, it's a commodity at some point in time, and when it was legal, it sold for very low prices and, within the range of normal agricultural products in many ways. I mean, after all, a lot of these things do come from plants. Cocaine's one of them. It takes a little bit of processing to extract it, but the cost on it growing it, processing it, getting it to the pharmacy and selling it, I would expect a gram of cocaine, maybe $20.
Well, it costs for the pharmaceutical companies to produce an ounce of cocaine, synthetic cocaine, which would suffice for everybody that I know that enjoys that drug. They can build basically an ounce of cocaine for about $25. So if they can build an ounce for $25, sell it through the distribution to the Walgreens for maybe $50.
Yeah.
And there are how many ounces or how many grams in an ounce? 28. So there's 28. Pharmacies get 28 grams of cocaine for $50, and if they sell every gram for, let's make it the math easy, $10, that'd be $280 an ounce, right?
Yep.
So the government takes $100 an ounce, and the pharmacy gets a pretty good hit, and everybody's happy, right?
Pretty much, except for the people that don't like it when people do things to themselves that they don't think they should do. Other than that, everybody's happy.
So let's look at it. So you're thinking you could buy, and I think your number's right, about $20 for a gram of cocaine. Right?
That sounds reasonable.
So, you're paying $20, getting a good deal. Pharmaceutical companies are getting a good deal. Walgreens is getting a good deal. The government's getting
a good deal. Everybody makes a tiny profit.
Right. So, in that...
Uncle Sam for covering the damage.
Right. So, we've established a price of $20 a gram for cocaine. So, let's talk about the opiate side of it. Do you think that in a regulated marketplace, we would still have a need for heroin?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful medicine. It's not a desirous recreational substance at all. That's why hardly anyone uses it. But it's something that is beneficial to mankind in many ways. And in Europe, they've been using it in medicine for quite some time. It's only, you know, mainly the United States that's being idiotic about it.
Well, from the perspective of a junkie, heroin addict, as opposed to a medicinal individual, I've spoken to a number of heroin addicts over the years, and I haven't asked each and every one of them this question, but I've asked enough of a representative group, representative of that number. I say, well, you know, if you could have pure morphine, cheap, and, you know, bought from a drugstore, would you still try to buy impure heroin at high prices on the black market? And nobody is as impaired as they've been. I've not had one person say, well, fuck the morphine, give me the heroin. So in that regard, I think heroin would be a redundant substance and not necessary to be sold over the counter. If an IV drug user addict used to shooting up impure heroin could get pure morphine, I think that would eliminate the need for heroin, at least in the regulated market, and I can't see much success for it in the black market. So theoretically, we could eliminate heroin from the drug list. Do you think that's kind of true, or from
the abuse list, perhaps? I still would suggest that it would be wise to have it available medicinally because
we do with fentanyl and all these other drugs.
Not the pharmaceutical stuff. I mean, the natural stuff. Actually, you know, one of the statements that you made about synthetic cocaine, I have no experience with that, so I can't, you know, judge from the experience. Oh,
me neither, Your Honor.
Okay, but my experience with synthetic opiates, of which I have quite a bit, is that they're less desirable than the natural forms. And my favorite example is Tylenol 3. You were in the military, just as I was, and whenever we went, if we had any kind of an injury or whatever, some kind of a pain, dental work, whatever, the drug of choice in the military for the active duty, Tylenol 3, which is acetaminophen with codeine, natural codeine. Now the big drug for that purpose is Vicodin, which is synthetic codeine and acetaminophen. And I can tell the difference. I don't like the effects, the side effects of Vicodin. You give me Tylenol 3, it does what I expect it to do, and it's a gentler kind of an effect. And you know, that's something that would be, the market would let you know whether or not you could actually create synthetic ones or have to go the natural route.
Well, let's look at the Vicodins and the Percocets, you know, hydrocodone and oxycodone, respectively. They're semi-synthetic morphine. They're made from thebaine, and they're relatively potent, and compared to opium, they're smoking opium, they're considerably more potent. Do you believe that we should be able to walk into our Walgreens, go back to the pharmacist, and buy a blister pack of 5-10 milligram Vicodins for say $20?
That's a wonderful price.
Well, they're very cheap to make.
Do. I mean, if I can do it now, I get a permission slip from a doctor that says, hey, you're allowed to have these. So I show up and say, hey, here's my little permission slip, and they give me the pills. So why, you know, let's cut out the middleman. You want to cut out health care costs? They'll make me go to the doctor to get my Vicodin.
Well, yeah, these pills are very cheap, Brian.
My wife
and I changed insurance companies a while back, and there was a 60, almost 90-day limbo where we had no insurance at all. And I refilled my Vicodin prescription, and I got 30 10-milligram Vicodins. Now, this is the cash price. This is no, copay or anything like that. I got 30 10-milligram Vicodins for $19.97. And you know those fuckers made a profit on that.
Oh yeah, totally. So, everybody involved made their little tiny profit.
Yes, yeah, so it's like cocaine. These drugs are very very inexpensive to synthesize and bring out. So, do you think that would be a fair price? 5-10 milligram Vicodins for $20?
It certainly sounds like it. I mean, it's mapping pretty well to what the cost is now, and basic market conditions apply. So the market would determine that if the demand went up and the supply didn't, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, if
that sounds like a reasonable rate.
Yeah, I mean, if they can make money at for $20 for 30, they can break out the cigars and champagne for selling.
Oh yeah.
Five of them for $20.
Well, it's the killer with a lot of these things too. They're just chemical formulas, so it's not like magic. And the raw materials for creating the compounds are cheap. That's why it's cheap to manufacture them.
So we've got a pattern developing here. We got $20 for a gram of coke, and we've got $20 for a blister pack of five Vicodin. We like to keep these uniform and simple. So, what about morphine? If somebody wanted to. Should we sell liquid morphine or just pill form?
I believe that people should be able to buy whatever is produced, provided that they meet the conditions that are applied evenly across to everyone. And the condition being your magic age, here you go. You want to buy this shit? Go ahead. You want to buy a chainsaw? Go ahead. Don't chop your leg off. Don't say I didn't warn you.
So should we sell...
Adults or adults?
Pardon me?
Go ahead.
Should we sell syringes and needles as well?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it wouldn't make sense to not do it because you're going to exacerbate the problems that occur with sharing needles and infections, et cetera. Death from septicemia. That's what's taking a lot of people out that are doing the drugs now. It's not so much the drug. Yeah, a lot of times it may be because they don't know what kind of a dose they're getting. But because of the impurities and the bad social behaviors, you're exacerbating the problem. So naturally... people who have that problem and are going to go do that have every right to do those things to themselves, and they should have access to a regulated market that's accessible and affordable so that they can do what they have to do.
So how much do you think our friendly pharmacist should sell an IV drug user for a fix, one fix? What would be a good price there?
Like, what's it worth to you, boy? Come on, I don't see you shaking yet.
Well, no, that's
how much money you got, sucker?
No, but I mean, seriously, how much do you think we should charge an IV drug user for?
I think it should be on par with any other, what intoxicant do we have the most experience with? Alcohol. What's it cost you for a buzz? A couple of shots will get you there, but it depends on what bar you go to. You go to a liquor store, it's cheaper. So let's say $5.
So
I can't imagine it costing more than that. It would probably actually cost less than that because, again, it's a commoditized product.
So we're breaking our $20 mold and we're going all the way down.
Element four packs.
For Element four packs.
$20. There you go.
Well, yeah, that's right. So we'll sell you forfeit. We'll sell you a day's worth for $20.
Sell it in bulk.
Yeah. Well,
go to Sam's Club. You can buy it by the gross.
Well, that's, it'd be a little facetious there, but yeah, I think that
absolutely.
We should, maybe a day's worth of morphine for an IV drug user.
No, I think it's any rules that suggest that it's proper or necessary to restrict how much of something somebody can buy. I mean,
right, but I'm saying
as much beer as I can fit in my car. It doesn't make any sense to try and come up with arbitrary restrictions on what somebody's quote-unquote allowed to buy. Because if you're going to do that, you have to build the tracking system to make it work. So give up already. The bottom line on all this crap, and that's another important facet of the whole thing. The world is not going to fall apart, and everybody's not going to become an addict for one simple reason. Being a drug addict sucks. The people who end up being drug addicts are typically people who are trying to cope with some kind of pain in their world. Economic pain, psychosocial pain, physical pain. They're not living desirous lifestyles. They're not choosing to do that. They're trying to cover up something else. They're trying to deal with something that they don't know how to deal with. So the vast majority of people, just because these drugs are out there and available and cheap in our model, they're not going to go out and start shooting up heroin.
No, I think it's pretty established. I mean, they've done enough surveys to show that if heroin were legal tomorrow, 99% of the American public would not run out and buy some and shoot up. So.
So but opium, they would.
Well, yeah, I think. Well, we're going to get to opium here in a second. Okay. But so let's say that they could get a day's worth of fixes for $20. That makes sense.
Well, it's a tad expensive.
$20 a day for really?
Oh yeah, that's like $600 a month. you're on welfare. I mean, the people that are doing that kind of crap don't have tremendous resources. So
well, not true. Some of them do. You just hear about the ones that don't more often than not.
Yeah, true. All the rich ones are the ones. Some of them you hear about.
Well, I think that.
But yeah, I guess that's about right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we
could
go down.
If you're an addict, then clearly you're going to be spending more than the average user would, certainly. So why not? Okay.
Well, I mean, let's just say it's $10 a day. I mean, in between 10 and 20, if it's $10 a day to support your morphine intravenous habit, that's $10 a day. It's $300 a month, $20 a day, $600 a month, $15 a day. What's that? $450 a month. That's pretty cheap by comparison to what they're paying now.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So, in essence, I mean, it could be like a pay raise.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and decrease crime, right? If everybody believes that people are out there robbing grandma to get money to buy heroin, then, hey, you know, heroin's cheaper. They don't need to rob grandma.
Yeah, I think that there would be, there's not that a lot of, the violence is, we're going to disagree on this later in the hour, but the violence is is primarily, well, I mean, we're not going to disagree on this, but the violence is primarily at the distribution and over distribution routes and territorial areas. I mean, there's not that much violence when it gets down to the buying and the selling on the street level. So
yeah, right now, absolutely.
Yeah, we would eliminate all of that crime associated with territorial and distribution problems. So there would be very little crime if you walk into your local CVS and for anywhere from $10 to $20. Get the necessary amount of morphine for your daily fix.
Sure.
Okay, so we're working
Coke,
on
acid,
we're working
whatever
on.
You want.
Pardon me.
I said Coke, acid, whatever you want.
Well, then let's stay in the genre of the opiates for just
okay.
A minute. Raw opium. Have you ever smoked raw opium?
I have.
And your thoughts?
I enjoy it tremendously, and it is the natural opiate that I would prefer. It is the opiate I would prefer over all others. If I had the smorgasbord of the opiate family, and I've actually had many of them for medical purposes, and, I took them for medical reasons.
Your Honor.
and I also enjoyed them for the effects that they created despite the medical effects. But if I had a choice, and I believe this is true of most people and most patterns that we would see in drug use, of all the different strengths of product in the class of drug that I enjoy, I'm going to gravitate toward lower doses in milder forms because I don't want to lose control. I want to enjoy the effects of the drugs and not be debilitated by the effect of the drugs.
Well, that's an important point you make because back prior to the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914, you could buy all different levels of potency. You could buy straight opium, which was the least potent. Then you could step up and buy laudanum, which was opium and wine. And then you could buy morphine. And then you could also buy heroin. So you got the good, better, best, and kill me aspect. That's my dog. Excuse me if anybody's ears perked up, but that was my dog. She's paying the rent. So you're right. If we did have the availability of all different potency levels, most people would gravitate towards, at least they did back in the day when they had that option, they would gravitate to the least potent form. So we would have...
Go ahead. In alcohol use, too.
Yeah, I mean, if everybody... I mean, you got your beer heads, you got your wine heads, and you got your hard liquor heads.
And then a class by themselves is the alcoholics.
Yes, but I mean, there are beer alcoholics, there are wine alcoholics, and there are hard liquor alcoholics. So the pathogens for that particular genetic dysfunction or for addiction can be very, very heavy in one individual and very light in another. If the only alcohol that was available was hard liquor, then everybody would drink it. But it's not one size fits all. People can get their buzz with booze or with beer. They get their buzz with wine, or they get their buzz with hard liquor. So the idea that people would gravitate towards heroin or morphine in a regulated market makes no sense if you look at the parallel experience in the alcohol deal. You know, some people, beer is enough. For other people, hard liquor is enough. So I think that opium would be a fairly popular substance in a regulated market, probably more so than some people are willing to admit. But I think that as far as an intoxicant, your experience and my experience seem to parallel. I think it's a very nice drug. The buzz is mild, the taste is very sweet, the aroma is very sweet, and you know, it doesn't last all that terribly long. And I think that someone could come home from work every night, take a few puffs off the opium bowl, and be just as satisfied if they drink a couple of beers. You think?
I do. You'd have to caveat it with the notion that your mileage may vary, and for any individual who knows what the too much point is. But that's the thing where you would just be aware of it, and that would be part of the equation. You'd say, I know that if I do this, I run this risk, and here is the relative risk, and then make your decision. So I absolutely enjoy smoking opium, and whenever I have the opportunity, I'll do it, but I certainly wouldn't be smoking it the way I would smoke pot.
No, you wouldn't do that. But would you decrease or completely eliminate your alcohol consumption if you were able to smoke opium, or do you like the booze buzz too?
I really hate the booze buzz. It's raw, unsettling, and you know, completely debilitating. But I love beer, so I'll never give up drinking. You know, well, obviously, if I get diabetes, you know, if one of my kidneys falls, you know, fails or whatever, then I might do it. But I love beer, and you know, it's one of the things in the world that, because I've had the opportunity to travel around a lot and do a lot of different things, I enjoy doing experimentation. And that's a natural part of my own education in drugs, obviously, that I am experimental by nature. I like experiencing things, and the things that I find that I like, I keep doing.
Well, let me ask you this. So we're in a regulated marketplace. You can get a gram of pure synthetic cocaine for $20 at CVS. You can get a day's worth of Vicodins for, well, I mean, not a day's worth. I mean, five, ten milligram Vicodins. You got some serious pain, or you're Rush Limbaugh, you know. But so we're in there. So we have these narcotic drugs, you know, the cocaine and the opiates. What do you think would happen to the alcohol industry with just in specific to these drugs? I know pot would have a greater influence, but do you think that, I guess the point I'm trying to make, do you think a lot of people drink because there's nothing else to sedate themselves that's legal, and if we were able to get these opiates that the alcohol lobby would suffer? Or do you think that like a lot of young people, but across the board, they take a Vicodin and they wash it down with a couple of beers or, you know, a martini, and then you get that volatile combination? Do you think that would be a problem of people more freely mixing opiates with alcohol?
Well, if you have the instructions for how to do it safely, you can mitigate a lot of that.
No, fuck instructions. I mean, nobody on the side of a cigarette pack is like, shit's going to kill you. That doesn't seem to deter anyone.
For the most part, to be careful about mixing drugs. And some drugs mix well with others, and other drugs don't. Alcohol doesn't mix well with anything, not even itself. But back to the focus of your point, which was how is this going to impact the alcohol industry? Certainly, there will be an impact, and you are correct that the biggest impact would come from pot, because if you have the choice of getting drunk or getting stoned, I believe in most of the people that I know who do both, they'll pick stoned. There's no doubt about it. For the people that are drinking hard liquor to deal with problems and sedate themselves, yeah, they're going to gravitate toward other drugs. I believe they would. Especially if they were able to determine that the other drugs were potentially less debilitating for them. I'm sure it would have an impact. I'm not sure what the extent of that impact would be, but it's good to shake up industry. It's good to cause people to remodel what they do and how they, whatever industry they're in and how they create and how they sell. Maybe we have too many distilleries. Maybe we have too many brewers. If people have a choice of doing other things, let the market do what the market does.
And right,
and interesting that I continue to hear from these people.
How willing do you think the pharmaceutical industry would be to jump back into this game, given the cover of regulatory marketplace?
Well, they're the ones that have the facilities to do it most efficiently and economically. So I guess the idea would be, well, are they going to taint themselves with this? Well, that's what generic manufacturers are for. There are tons of generic manufacturers who are in it to make money. They're not the big powerhouse pharmaceutical companies. There are no patents on these things. They're chemical compounds. Their formulas for these things are not patented. They're widely known. They're easy to do. So generic drug companies can pick up that manufacturing of these substances, no problem.
Well, don't you think just to kind of, you know, keep too much competition at bay, that all of these substances should be, you know, a generic form? I mean, you don't want to have, you know, Mr. Frank's magic cocaine and, or, you know, Mrs. Smith's soothing syrup for opium and things of that nature. Do you think that it should be a very generic business, no advertising, and, you know, it's like McDonald's. The McDonald's Big Mac you eat in Florida is going to taste the same as the McDonald's Big Mac and cost the same as you eat in California. So do you think we should have competition for drug prices, or should we have a fixed price and that's what everybody sells it for and there's no advertising allowed, just to kind of, you know, keep the free market out of the controlled market?
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line that it is, it's impossible to go out there and get a brand name for a commodity.
Well, plus you don't want the
clips.
You don't want one pharmacy, you know, advertising, you know, buy one get one free.
Oh yeah.
You know, you mean?
Well, I don't know about you.
Well, but I'm saying, I mean, you don't want to create that type of atmosphere.
Absolutely.
So it's like it's $20 here, $20 there, and $20 everywhere, and this is the brand, and this is the way it is. And
yeah, I would prefer that kind of model myself. But again, it's going to be one of the things where the states are the experimental laboratories, and they figure out their own little regulatory scheme. So I'm not sure. But, you know, generically, yes, these things will be generic. They will be cheap, and there's no reason in the world for anybody to ever go out there and try to market a brand name of a commodity chemical. You know, they'd be like, oh, you know, Uncle Ed's magic paper clips. Well, you know, you might have paper clips, but you don't have Uncle Ed's. That point is gone when these things first emerged as products. That was a potential to create name branding, but now it's, you know.
Do you think we should allow advertising in this regulated market at all?
No, absolutely not. But I would apply that to all recreational intoxicants, period. I wouldn't even have advertising for booze or cigarettes.
That's a good point. I agree completely. I think that of course the alcohol and the tobacco lobby would scream bloody murder if we're introducing new competition and taking away their advertising capabilities. But I'm with you. I think we should not advertise alcohol. We should not advertise cigarettes. I mean, everybody knows where to buy them, and you can. I would be fine with, you know, having YouTube channels for Budweiser, where you want to find out what the latest beer is. You know, go to the internet, but not the TV or newspapers and stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. No billboards, no magazine advertising. Excellent. Just put it on the internet, and then those who are seeking it could find it. And you just talk about your product and what you have to offer. There you go. If you want to create a market niche for yourself, you're not going to be able to do it in those drugs.
Well, no, but
you
I know, think...
Not, you could do it.
Yeah,
not,
I think if there's a universal price, you can only buy them at pharmacies, then you control the market, and you don't let anybody get crazy. Like I said, no two-for-one specials buy my morphine, it's better than Walgreens morphine type of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But I disagree a little bit with you. I do believe that the major pharmaceutical companies would jump on this like stink on shit, especially if it's got it's a legal product. I mean, I think they would view it just as any other substance. But maybe we would since we're not going to have different brands out there, should we pick like a homegrown American pharmaceutical company and give them all the business, as opposed to anyone from Switzerland or France? Should we keep it all inside the border? in essence, have the state.
These kinds of things.
Pardon me?
I don't think you can contain these kinds of things. And I don't think it would make sense to try to do that either. Ultimately, because it is a commodity, you can manufacture it anywhere. You can do it in third world countries and allow them to boost up their economies and their people. I don't see why it would make sense to try and restrict it to the U.S.
Well, I mean, there's not going to be that much business out there. I mean, there's going to be business, but and again, if you let every pharmaceutical company into the game, then you're going to have some sort of a competitive nature out there. I think that, you know.
Well, but there's not enough money in it. That's why I think they wouldn't play. They make their money off of new patents that they can generate and charge you $300 a month for the medicine.
If they could make an extra $2 or $3 billion on a product category without human trials, obviously they're not going to be necessary.
Really?
I think that they would.
They would probably like slip something into it without us knowing it.
Well, you know, back when Harrison was passed in 1914, and Sears and a lot of other retailers were forced to take that product out of their product bag, you can bet that there were some pretty pissed off CEOs in the executive boardroom because they saw that as an economic hit to their bottom line when they were no longer able to sell those products. So I think the idea of having one or possibly two pharmaceutical companies, or just create a new pharmaceutical company that did nothing but narcotics. They didn't have to do all the cholesterol drugs and all this kind of stuff. A company set up specifically to produce narcotics. I kind of like that. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a cool idea. And it could probably be made to work fairly easily. The big issue then would be if Prohibition was not ended worldwide, then there would be a problem with diversion.
Yeah, but don't you think if we end Prohibition, everybody else is going to go like the old domino theory?
I certainly hope so. It's the only logical thing to do, and it's the only way it can possibly work. Everybody has to play, and everybody has to agree that this is the only sensible thing to do, is to end this prohibition nonsense, regulate the market instead of trying to eliminate it. And that's the failure point right now, is that they're thinking that they can eliminate this, and it's absurd. You can't stop people from doing things to themselves, especially things that make them happy. They're not going to stop.
Well, let's go back to the product offering again. I meant to talk about this when we were doing the cocaine thing, but did you see in the paper the other day where apparently Red Bull makes this product called Simply Cola? And May 19th, several states over in Germany banned it because they found that there were 0.4 micrograms of cocaine. I mean, this is like a grain of sand and not even enough to get a gnat's nose numb, But at 0.4 micrograms of cocaine in every can. And I thought that was... Did you see that? I mean, did you hear anything about that? That's hysterical.
It is hysterical. And I did hear about it, but that's thanks to you, because I saw you had posted something about it.
Oh.
And it's absurd.
Well, yeah. It's great. I mean, and Red Bull, I mean, they're out of Salzburg, Austria. And their statement was that they used decocainized. And I looked all over that fucking word. I think they pulled that out of thin air. They decocainized the coca leaf.
I think they're telling the truth, and I think that is the magic ingredient in Coca-Cola, is the extract from the coca leaves.
Yeah, but the thing was, the irony I felt of, I mean, first of all, I never knew Red Bull had a Simply Cola product, but yeah. it was 100 years ago when the FDA was formed in 1906. The FDA was formed in around. This time, 100 years ago, the FDA was in a big fight with Coca-Cola over the fact that the original, truly classic Coke did have the stimulative properties of the coca leaf in their product.
Absolutely.
And that was, I believe, the origination of the secret formula, which they've marketed and made, made big money with the fact that, our product is so good that the formula is secret. But I think that the formula was secret because they told the FDA to go fuck themselves, and they weren't going to tell them what was in there, and they kept it secret because they knew, in fact, that there was cocaine in their product. But that's just a little sidebar trivia thing. That's where the origination of the secret formula for Coca-Cola. But I thought it was interesting. It was 100 years, almost 100 years ago exactly, when this controversy first erupted, and now we have Red Bull Simply Cola. The interesting thing is that it's not, I mean, it's being banned in a few more places over there, but it is still available here. And the people that I called, a couple of friends that drink Red Bull, and I said, have you ever heard of Red Bull Simply Cola? And none of them had. But I think once this gets a little bit more known, and especially if the United States, which is still legal, you can buy Simply Cola, Red Bull, Simply Cola here in the States. And I think that's not going to last very long, because I think our government will take up the ban on that as well. But I just found that very interesting that Simply Cola, this Red Bull product, is being banned because of cocaine. 100 years later, we're starting the cycle again, which is pretty. I might go out and buy some myself just to try it.
Well, that's what zero tolerance does to you.
Yes, exactly. So the point that I was trying to make before I got off track here, dreaming about drinking Simply Cola, is that Morales down in, I think, Bolivia, isn't he Bolivia Morales?
Yeah, Evo Morales.
Yeah. He wants to normalize the coca leaf business, and he wants to put it in teas and colas, non-alcoholic beverages, and sell it as a stimulant type of product, very similar to coffee. I think that's a good idea. What do you think?
I absolutely agree, and it's probably better to have products that have cocaine in them than it is to have products with caffeine in them, believe it or not.
Yeah, Coke is a cleaner drug for your head and for your body.
Absolutely. And that's part of their culture down there, for not just hundreds of years, but thousands of years. That's part of what they do. It's part of who they are. And for us to go out and wage war on them and destroy their crops and all that kind of stuff is complete nonsense. So, and that's another example of my point, that I believe that if you're given the choice, you're going to gravitate toward milder forms of a drug in smaller doses. You're going to take an effective dose.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, you're listening to The Opium Den with Brian C. Bennett. We're talking about what a regulated market, what that scheme would look like. Brian is the author of The Anti-Drug War. Go to Google, put in Anti-Drug War, and you'll get all of Brian's years of dedicated work of collating all of the drug statistics and reports that are out there. So, let's see here. And if you're listening, please send us an email. It's right there on the homepage. Click the email Daniel button. Send us an email with a question or a comment. Let us know what you're thinking out there. We're talking about the actual infrastructure of a regulated marketplace for narcotics, and we have pretty much hammered the cocaine portion, the Vicodin and Percocet portion, the opium. No, we haven't really hit the opium thing yet. How, when you bought opium, did you buy it by the gram? Did you buy it by the eyeball piece? What was the price structure when you bought opium?
I have no answer for you in that, Daniel, because I never had to buy it. Other people were gracious and offered it. Those are my only experiences with opium.
So you've never had to buy it?
I did not.
Well,
but if I
it's pretty. It's pretty cheap.
Absolutely. Well, I think it would have to be sold pretty much in the same kinds of places that you would license to sell cannabis products. I believe that would fit in the same class. I think really that what the model should be is that if it's a plant material product, sell it. A specific license for vending natural intoxicants. So that would include mushrooms. And then have a different sort of licensing scheme, which already exists for selling chemical pharmaceutical products. So, if you do the extract out of it and you turn it into coke, go to the drugstore. If you take the extract out and make it into morphine, go to the drugstore. You want to smoke opium? Go to the organic store.
Well, I'm not so sure. I think what we would probably have to be able to do in a regulated market is keep soft drugs away from hard drugs, and when I say hard drugs, those are the addictive types. I think you would probably, In my scheme of things, I believe that the opium should be sold alongside the Vicodins and the other substances inside of Walgreens and CVS. I don't think we'd want to mix the cannabis with the opium, but you know.
Okay, how would you classify tobacco and alcohol? Are they hard drugs or soft drugs?
Well, tobacco is the hardest drug, but it's not an intoxicant. So, I mean, in the classic sense of the word, you don't smoke a cigarette and get high. I mean, your brain chemistry alters, but it's not an intoxicant in the conventional sense. But I think that it would be good to separate the drugs by category and class. I don't think alcohol has anything remotely resembles cocaine or morphine or anything like that. So I like the scheme that we have now for the most part of buying alcohol, but I don't think we would include any type of currently illegal substance in the same like a grocery store or tobacco store or anything like that. I don't think that would work. But what I do think would work for us, let's move into the cannabis aspect of it. I like the idea of garden centers. You know, we down here, there's plenty of them, and, you know, they're all over the place. But they're good growers. Obviously, they've established that through their garden centers. And I think cannabis, that would be the natural distribution for cannabis, whether in the plant stage of, you know, they'd start the plant and then you go and you buy the plant, take it home and nurture it yourself. Or you just go and you buy the product already cured, bagged, and budded up, so to speak. So that's what I think. But how would you sell cannabis? And not only where would you sell it, but what do you think the transactional quantity would be? How do you think that would work? Or give me what you think would be the best way to sell pot in the U.S.
Well, I like your idea of having a garden center for the living plants. If you want to buy clones, growing equipment, you know, chemicals for fertilizers, et cetera, then I think that would be a wise thing and a good place for that to happen. But for, you know, the purchase of the intoxicant end product, I believe, would have to be in the form of a storefront, just like any other tobacconist model or bar. Just the Amsterdam model, basically, for the consumption end of things. You go in there, you can buy some, you can sit there and smoke it if you feel like it, but also be able to buy larger quantities than they allow you to buy in the Netherlands. Again, I would favor no restrictions on purchase. It's like how much you want, how much money do you have? That's how much you can buy. I think it would be silly to come up with any arbitrary limit on what I'm allowed to buy. So that's the model I would take. Go get the live plants at the garden center and the seeds and the information and go buy the end product in a cannabis shop. I would open one of those. And I think for pricing, then you're going to be looking at, being able to offer a variety of products from commercial grade marijuana, cannabis, gourmet grade cannabis, hash and hash oil. And the pricing range, I think, I always thought that the most I should ever really have to pay for the best quality dope in the world is $100 an ounce. And I think if there was open competition and garden centers and that sort of thing, then that could happen, and that would be a viable price point. And then cheaper stuff, obviously, $20 an ounce for commercial grade probably makes sense.
Well, do you think there'd be that much business in a commercial grade deal? I mean, if you could buy blueberry for $6 a gram, or, you know, dirt weed commercial shit for $4 a gram, do you think there would be that much gravitation? I know you're going to relate back to the dose and the like, but do you think there would be that much business for low grade THC? Because I think the people who drink beer, if they could drink, you know, the best, most potent, greatest beer that they know that's out there, I mean, you know, Bud Light versus some of these esoteric high end beers. If there wasn't that much price difference, do you think people would still drink Bud if they could drink that much better beer for another 50 cents or a dollar a bottle?
The Jefferson side of me says yes. The Adam side says no. Well, you know, I mean, some people don't care about quality, and they'll do the, well, you know, whatever does the trick kind of thing, depending upon what their pocketbook says. But, yeah, in general, if the market was allowed to move in its natural directions, you're going to get higher quality product, and the lower quality stuff would disappear.
Well, I'm going to go back to what you said a moment ago, only because my wife walked in and a friend of ours emailed her and also emailed me that they were unable to get on the show. So I was trying to figure out if they were calling in, and if they are, they can't call in because at this point our technology is limited to one phone call at a time, and emails are good. So I want to go back to the pot thing. What do you think that they should be sold in tobacco shops? I know you talked about the plants and the garden center idea, but if you want to get, just buy it already processed, and where would you suggest that to be sold?
Well, my preference would be from either end, selling or purchasing, that I would want to go to a store like a tobacconist, but it would be a cannabis shop. Where there was cannabis products for sale. I don't necessarily think that tobacco and cannabis products should be sold together. It's somebody else's choice. It's like, again, whatever the market will bear, and states will come up with different models about what's allowed until sanity prevails. But my model would be that I have this model. This is what I want to do. I really started doing the work that I've done simply because I want to be able to smoke pot without having anybody go ballistic on my ass. And I want to open a store and sell the best quality cannabis products to people who want to buy them.
What do you think the transactional quantity will be? Now people, they'll buy a quarter ounce, a half ounce, whatever. They'll buy and hold because they'll hoard it a little bit because they don't know when they're going to get any next. So when you know that you have the access on a daily basis to go buy, go buy weed, what do you think the transactional quantity will be? The individual purchase.
Whatever you're comfortable having to return to the store for. What I do when I buy beer, I buy gourmet beer, and I drink good, high-quality beer. So sometimes I'll just go and buy a boatload of different varieties of beer and just stash them away and slowly drink them over time. The model that I use is, how many times do I want to have to go back to the store? I don't really feel like going back to the store all the time, and I like variety. So I would go out and purchase... maybe once a month I would go out and buy whatever the hell I needed for the month, just because I hate having to go back and forth driving to the store all the time.
So that would be the way you would buy cannabis. You'd buy, a month's supply.
Yeah, probably, because that's what I do basically with beer, and I try to buy commodity level.
Do you have an alcohol problem, Brian?
Say again?
Do you have an alcohol problem?
No. Well, yeah. I never have enough beers.
Really?
No, even with liquor, I go to the liquor store to buy rum because my wife and I have a little tradition, depending upon what the specific reality show of the month we're watching, to have rum drinks while we're watching the show. So we drink rum. And I'm not going to go out and buy, a pint of rum and have to go back every once in a while and get another pint. I'm going to buy a half gallon of it. I don't feel like having to go back to the store all the time.
Well, over in Amsterdam...
I'm going to buy a quarter pound. Shut up.
Yeah, over in Amsterdam... Don't quote me out there, and if any listeners can correct me, please do. But I don't think you can buy more than like 4 or 5 grams of cannabis at a time. Each individual packet has that in there. You can stand there all day and buy individual packets. But as far as transactional quantity, I think like 5 grams is the limit.
That is correct. And the only reason they do that is for political reasons, not for market reasons.
Stoners can't count higher than five.
Well, they don't want to.
Right.
They get tired of counting at that point.
Well, that was a slight against donors. It probably wasn't very stereotypical, but not true. But yeah, I think that, for me personally, I smoke less than 2 ounces of pot a year. I'm a very, light smoker. I smoke on a fairly regular basis, but I smoke the best cannabis that you can find. Then I'll pinch off a little bit of a bud, put it in my favorite little glass bowl, and it's worth about 2 good hits, and that's my daily consumption, or when I do consume, which is most days, that's about what I smoke. So I'm less than a 2 ounce a year guy, so I'd probably go out and buy a few grams of this and a few grams of that, and smoke them, and then go back to the store. I found myself going to the fucking cafes every single day in Amsterdam. I'd buy a couple of things, a hash, and I'd go home and smoke. But it just seemed like I like to go to the cafes every day. And if we had that type of a distribution system, I would probably go to to go to cafes a lot as well. So,
well, that's another interesting point. It depends on where you live, too. If you live in the city area, then the cafe model and going there and doing social interaction and buying small quantities makes sense.
Do you think we'll have smoking establishments like they have in Amsterdam? Do you think we'll actually have places where you can go and smoke? I mean, we may, you know.
I think we should.
But do you think that should be part of the scheme right from the get-go? I mean, if we're gonna do this, let's do it right and not say, well, if we don't have a lot of problems later on, we'll let you have smoking parlors. Don't you think we should have our own sort of, coffee shop system here?
Absolutely, and right from the start, like you say, not as an afterthought. This is like, look, I'm doing something that's perfectly fine. It's perfectly legitimate. It's being done by people who are consenting to the activity. Keep your nose out of it. If you don't like it, shut the hell up and go somewhere else. I don't go busting in on churches and synagogues and telling them they're all stupid. So, you know, leave people alone. Let them do what they do. And until they do something directly to some other person who doesn't want it done to them, leave them alone. You know, I mean, the failure that we have in this is that people have taken it upon themselves to try to control the behavior of others that they direct toward themselves. So if we loosen that up and say, look, you know, let live and let live. Everybody's different. If I'm allowed to go to a bar, then why can't I go to a cannabis shop and sit around and talk to my friends and socialize and smoke pot and get wireless access so I can listen to Daniel's show?
Well, well, if that's, you know, listening to me is not enough to make you want to get high, I don't know what is. So we kind of, you know, rambled just a little bit here, but in this regulatory scheme, we seem to be in agreement that pharmaceutical companies should be in the production side of it, and our drugstore chain should be in the distribution side of it, and we'd have a mix of garden centers and cannabis cafes where the acquisition and potentially the smoking of cannabis. But what I was thinking is that at least. I know it's going to sound incremental and contradict what I said a while back, but you can't drive around with an open container of alcohol. That's against the law. And you shouldn't be able to drive around with an open baggie of weed. So if you're going to buy it, do you think it should come in those little hermetically sealed packages so that you can drive home with it, and if you get pulled over for some other type of infraction, you're not going to be arrested for similar as an open container law, open container violation. Do you think that makes sense?
It's almost another entire show because there's too many factors. But in general, the real rule should be that you can't drive while you're under the influence or to the point where you're debilitated. All right, well, what does that mean? All cop cars have video cameras. If you're driving erratically, I don't give a shit why you're driving erratically. The cop can pull you over, give you a ticket, do some tests. If he thinks that you're inebriated or under the influence of something that incapacitates you, then why not arrest you? Go ahead.
Well, that's a good point, I want to finish up on that thought because I have that in my notes to get to this. My thinking is if we repeal drug prohibition and give people the right to consume whatever substance they want in the privacy of their own home or in the home of friends and the like. Part of that that freedom should come a responsibility to the private sector that if you're out and about and you get caught and you're under the influence, I think you should be fucked. I think that our DUI laws now favor the wealthy over the poor. If you get caught for a DUI, rich guy hires a lawyer, gets it busted down to reckless op, and he's out there to play again, whereas someone without the funding to get a good lawyer, if they get a lawyer at all, it's a public defender, and they don't get those DUIs busted down to reckless op. So I think we should make it a very strong penalty, and a penalty that you can't cop a plea on if you're caught out in the public arena endangering others under the influence. Do you agree that we should just throw the book at people, make it a much more stringent penalty, because that might be one of the trade-offs we have to make in a regulated marketplace to say that if we're going to give you the responsibility and the freedom, or the freedom to do this, the responsibilities if you're out and about, we're going to throw the book at you. I would make that as a trade-off. I would be more than willing to agree to not a draconian law for under the influence, but I would be very supportive of a very stiff law of a stiff penalty if you're caught in the public arena behind the wheel of a car or on a motorcycle or something like that where you're endangering others under the influence. Would you be willing to trade? Would you be willing to trade that for the freedom to get high?
Of course, and the issue really is that if you're incapable of driving, we really shouldn't have to care why. You can get prescription chemicals that can do that to you. They have little warning labels on them. So if you apply it across the board evenly, and like you said, I really agree. The best thing you said was make it so you can't plea bargain. You're going to get hammered. You're driving your car and endangering others. That matters. So I don't care what it is that you've done that made it so incapacitated and can't control your car. If you present a danger to others, a reckless danger to others like that, then absolutely throw the book at them. Absolutely. And that's not a trade-off. That's a requirement for life in general. I don't want you texting on the phone. I don't want you reading the newspaper, for God's sake. If you're driving a car, you have a deadly weapon in your hands, and you need to control every aspect of it at every moment in time, period.
Yeah, I drive a little bit better when I'm high. And I'm not saying that facetiously. I tend to be, I push the speed limit quite often. And when I got a buzz on, I tend to, one, leave a little earlier for where I'm going so I don't have to rush. And I do tend to drive a little better. And I know a lot of people who say that as well. Do you drive better when you're high than when, say, you got a few beers in you or when you're completely sober? I mean, what's your driving pattern under the influence? Just as a hypothetical.
Primo Bud or Commercial Bud?
Well, no, Primo, baby. We're too old to drink shitty or to smoke shitty weed.
Here's my experience. Basically, weed is one of the things that you actually can learn how to control better the more experience you have with it. And interestingly enough, I found an article from, I think it was like 1973 in the Saturday Evening Post. And they were complaining about all the dopers out there. Marijuana is very popular. People were getting stoned and driving around smoking joints. not me.
Your Honor.
What happened was that they were pissed because they said that magically, somehow, when a cop pulled over somebody who was stoned, they could, get themselves together, and the cop couldn't tell they were high. And that really pissed them off. And that's my experience with weed. It's one of those things that when you first start doing it, you need some training wheels because you laugh at everything, you're an idiot, you're a little bit clumsy, you knock things over, you drop things. But as time goes by, unlike some other drugs, with weed you really can learn how to handle it better through experience. So when I'm under the influence, I'm not blitzed, I'm not going to get behind the wheel then. But when I'm still buzzed, I find that I'm less aggressive. And I will slow down a little bit because I'm more peaceful. So the idea that you become reckless and stupid behind the wheel under the influence of marijuana, just like you do with alcohol, is one of the fallacies that's out there among people in general.
If I was out on the road and had to follow somebody that was impaired, I would much rather follow somebody that's on a big load of coke than on a big load of booze. I mean, those fuckers on coke, they may drive a little faster, but they're going to stay between the fucking lines.
Yeah, and they'll be out of your way quick.
I want to finish up, Brian, with one piece of personal news. Did you see where Howard Waldridge got fired from Leap?
No, I didn't. Oh, my God, what happened?
Well, apparently, I just did an interview with Howard a couple of days ago. It'll be up on the archive links here. But for those of you who are listening, Howard Waldridge was one of the five founding members of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, which is on the street vernacular, LEAP. And apparently there was some discord in the ranks, and there was a desire for a new executive director. Jack Cole had been the executive director, I guess, from the get-go. And there were some clamoring for new blood. And the board sent out questionnaires on, whether they felt Jack should be replaced, should be retained, or whatever. And apparently Howard put back one of the more, I can't think of the right word, but he was not in favor of Jack remaining as the executive director. And when the smoke settled and smoke cleared and the executive director got Jack's 30-page rebuttal against all of the complaints and the like that the others felt, Howard had the most, I guess, blatant one, less politically correct. So Jack Cole fired him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
No shit, wow. So Howard, he I think he's got another job lined up, and he was kind of, you know, being a little coy about it. But Howard was a good guy. I mean, he's up on Capitol Hill almost every day, and he has spoken to every single member's congressional member's office. He hasn't spoken to all of the actual Congress people, but he's been at every single office, and he's a tireless worker out there. And for him to be unceremoniously dumped by Jack Cole, I thought was very odd. So anyway, I just thought I'd put that into at the end of our show to let you know that had transpired.
Wow, I'm speechless because I've met both of those guys. I like them both, and you're right. Howard has been an absolute workhorse, and no pun intended, because he did that whole thing with Misty.
Yeah, rode across the country on his horse.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually helped do some of the promo for that. And, you know, the guy's, like you said, tireless. He's out there constantly telling people and constantly talking to Congress people. Holy crow. Yeah, and I have to find out what the whole story is on this.
Well, he sent, you know, I think it's pretty much true to what I just told you, because he sent me.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what his complaints were against Jack. I mean, generically I know, but specifically I don't. But he sent me. In his email, he sent me the copy of the email that Jack Cole sent firing him.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy. It was handled in typical cop fashion. And if you're listening, Howard or Jack, I apologize. But it was like, you know, the blue line type of thing. You know, you're not with us, so you're against us. Get the fuck out the door. I mean, they just threw his ass out like yesterday's trash. And it was a very copish type of thing. A very copish thing.
But
yeah. Well, anyway, Brian, we're going to skedaddle here. We're running a little bit over my grace period on this wave streaming thing that we do. But I want to thank you for joining us inside the Opium Den tonight. Again, all of you listeners out there, go to Google and put in anti-drug war, and you'll be very much impressed with the amount of information that Brian has on that website. Every statistic, every report, everything has been collated and put together in a very usable format. It saves you a tremendous amount of time searching the internet for this particular statistic or that particular report. Brian's got it all under one roof, so to speak, and that's the anti-drug war or Brian C. Bennett. Either one will get you at the top of the Google list. So, Brian, we want to thank you for joining us this evening, taking the Opium Den challenge, so to speak. And you back up on the internet yet?
Not yet. Very soon.
Very soon.
Believe me, as soon as I get back on, I will let everybody know.
I'm
hooked, man. I need internet.
Okay.
I need a big dose every day.
Okay, well, again,
thanks for having me on, Daniel. It's a true pleasure and an honor.
Well, I'm sure we'll be speaking again down the road, Brian, but thanks a lot, and we'll talk at you later.
All right, take care, my friend.
All right, you too. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, that was Brian C. Bennett, and Brian's a good guy. Go to his website, The Anti-Drug War. Check him out. There's a tremendous amount of information. If you're a college student and need statistical information for any type of report with regards to prohibition of the drug war, you're going to be impressed with Brian's website. It's a very good thing. So again, thank you for tuning in, and we'll be back again next Thursday night. I appreciate it. This is Daniel Williams inside the Opium Den. Stay healthy and high when it helps.